Hey, this is Scott Snyder. I'm writing All-Star Batman this year, and you're listening to the Comic Syndicate.
I'm Mitch Gerrans, the artist of Sheriff of Babylon.
I'm Tom King, the writer of Sheriff of Babylon, and you're listening to the Comic Syndicate.
This is Kevin Conroy, the voice of Batman, and you're listening to the Comics Syndicate.
Hi, my name is Brian Bucciolato, and I listen to Comic Syndicate.
Hi, this is Chris Michello. We're hanging out here at Frank and Sons, and we're having a good time on a Sunday or Saturday afternoon. And you're listening to me live on Comic Syndicate.
Hi, this is Brian Michael Bendis, and you are listening to the Comic Syndicate.
Comic Talk.
So we'll get started.
Too much.
So Sean, I'll let you talk for a little bit, I guess.
Yeah, okay, so I will say, I mean, he basically covered what our relationship was. Charles and I met, it's so weird. We met online. That's all creepiest relationships start. We were Bendis, Brian Michael Bendis message board people, Bendis boarders. If you know the nomenclature, Benbo boarders.
Benbos.
We started out, I as far as we can both remember, we started out working together on like an anthology book that a bunch of people on the Bendis board were working on, like artists and writers, and I can't think of all the names off the top of my head, but
tons. But and some of those guys have gone.
Yeah, like 70% of that board has gone on to do like comics that you're reading now.
Jonathan Hickman, Josh Fialkov, me, Nick Spencer. Lots of Gary Mixed Garage, I think, was on that board. Like, lots of really talented people came out of that.
Comic Book Resources, Albert Chang, CBR's
editor
in chief. Albert Chang was big on the board.
So, to roll back briefly, the reason I was on the Bendis board is because I wanted to get into comics because I had started writing novels and doing some other things that hadn't worked out for me creatively as well as I wanted to. And I thought comics seemed like a really fun, interesting, creative endeavor. And at that time, so this is probably mid-2000s, there were a number of very vibrant online communities. The Bendis board was one, Miller World was another, I think there's another that I'm spacing, but they would all have these very tight-knit people who would talk about making comics and getting into comics. And so I learned a lot about how comics are made, like how the sausage is made, basically, and how to network and how to do it. And one of the other people that was doing that at the same time was Sean. So that's how we came to know each other. And then for the decade or so since then, again, we've been working pretty closely. So that's why he's here.
Yeah.
And I guess you probably know why I'm here, and I guess we can...
So Charles Soule began as this young boy that you see over here.
Yes.
Let's just examine this photo, though.
Yeah, there's some details.
First of all, I would like to point out his smug face.
Yeah.
But more importantly, I would like to point out, he's Michael Jackson Club.
Yes.
Charles, can you explain? Oh, I don't know what that was or why that was in there. Apologize.
Explain the Michael Jackson Club. Well, Michael Jackson was a very famous singer. He had a lot of big hit songs.
Why are you wearing his glove?
Oh, that's what you want. I thought it was the most baddest ass thing in the world. That glove. At that time, I wore that glove all the time. I basically wore it like pretty constantly. My little brother tells me that whose shoulder my hand is on there, the little baby head there, is my little brother.
He still looks like that. Don't bring it up.
Tells me that I actually was wearing it on the wrong hand, like Michael Jackson wore it on his other hand. But whatever, I still thought I was sweet. So I haven't really ever grown out of it. I wish I still had the glove. The glove is long gone. It got kind of like yellowed and filthy. But I wish I still had that glove. I'd wear it today. So that was me back then. Super cool, super cool.
So you mentioned also that you were, when we had first met and prior to coming on the board, you were writing novels.
Yeah.
And I've read both of those novels, and they're great. And when are they coming out?
Right, so skipping a little ahead from that, from the Michael Jackson glove era, I went to law school. I went to college and I went to law school, and I was and continue to be a practicing lawyer. And so part of getting into writing was born out of a huge fear that I had that I wouldn't be able to have a creative life anymore, because lawyering is very time consuming, and I really wanted to think of a way that I could continue to make things. I've been a musician. I still am a musician as well. I've been a musician very, very heavily since before the Michael Jackson picture. My mom had me playing violin when I was three. So I really love music, and I still do. But I knew that being a lawyer, I couldn't just be like, all right, guys, I'm going to go on tour. I'm going to go play the happy hour gig or whatever. Like, they just weren't going to have it. So I figured writing was a way, something I could do after I got home in my spare time on the subway. So I started writing a novel. It's called The Land of 10,000 Things. It's so good. And it's really good. It's about China.
Ancient China, though. And, like, dragons. It's, guys, it's tight.
Thanks, John. Yeah. I like it. So I wrote it. I'm still very happy with it, but I was also like a first-time author, and like, you know, it's not easy to get a novel published under any circumstances. So that book went out. It did get picked up. My agent at the time told me to, you know, like, write something else. It's that simple. The first book took taking like 3 years, but I did start writing a second book. It's called The Oracle Year, which is about a man who sort of has a dream about the future, and then how that affects him in the world as he slowly reveals the pieces of that dream to the world. That, however, Land of 10,000 Things is probably in a drawer for the time being, but The Oracle Year is I'm working on it very, very heavily now. I finished the last draft of it around 2007, and I put it in the drawer, but recently I pulled it back out because I had, like, my profile is bigger now, so people are interested in what I have to write. And so I have an agent who really wants to try and get it into the world. So hopefully we'll all be reading within the next year or two. Turns out writing a good novel is really hard. So, you know, I'm happy with it, but I could be happier.
And that brings us to about this era of your life. This is when we met. I found this. When was your daughter born?
She was born in 2006.
Okay, so this is an email from 2006. You can tell, A, because he mentions that his daughter was born, but also because he says he was... This is my favorite. After announcing her intention to arrive just as the Veronica Mars finale was starting on Tuesday night, that was sort of a pain, but I just downloaded it later so I won't have to resent the baby forever.
Yeah. Remember Veronica Mars? That was a big, big deal in my life at the time, I guess. Yeah.
So that brings us to the first published
work. Yeah.
Which is, And I brought up the novels only to sort of highlight the idea that because I know when I was reading it right now, I'm still waiting. But I know that even longer ago, you know, rejection is the hardest thing to get over, and the toughest part of doing this is to just push through no one caring until someone starts caring. And I think that it's something that I always like being reminded of when I came to see panels of all, you know, writers that I like. Was like, yeah, there was a whole bunch of years before he was writing Daredevil that, like, no one gave a shit. And he, you know, how many different places did Strongman go to?
Oh, a bunch. I
mean, raw, at least five, six.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of those publishers, like, aren't even around anymore. But yeah, Strongman was the first book that I had published, really. It's about a drunk old luchador who, you know, decides he's going to get his life back together and starts beating up people on the street randomly. That's him. That's T-Grade. So I should also mention, if you guys have questions about any of this stuff, I was going to just pop
your
hand.
Yeah, there's no Q&A at the end. Just make Q&A's out.
Yeah, make Q's and good A's. So... Anyway, so yeah, so Strongman.
Yeah, that's early stuff. This is early stuff. Yeah, this is, I found another email. This was like him asking me if I would letter the first 7 pages of his Strongman pitch. So that was prior even to the book existing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
really
layouts.
It's really, it's just fun. Yeah, Alan Blackwell is the artist on that book. It's really, I don't see this stuff. I haven't looked at a lot of stuff in a long time.
I haven't
had the time. But yeah, anyway, so yeah, the pitching process is very, particularly when you're not known, is really grueling, and you know, you have to get used to the fact that nobody's gonna care. Nobody wants to see your work because they have a lot of other work from people that they already know. There's a lot of comics coming out, there's a lot of everything coming out. So you have to, I mean, the thing that I tell people when they ask about it is just make sure whatever you're pitching is as good as other stuff that's on the shelves. So as long as it's as good as the worst thing on the shelves, then it's worth trying to show it to people and pitch it. So that,
yeah, so buy Galaxies for Hire and then write a book slightly better than that and you're a human.
Oh, that's another good slide. So that is the very first money I ever made from comics.
I hate your address.
Thank you. Yes. I do live in Attorneyville, New York. It's all lawyers.
That's the other thing we should mention. If you don't know, and to jump back a little bit, the whole like, oh yeah, so I heard about Edward's struggles and stuff. Like, he was a lawyer. So it's not like he was getting rejected and eating top ramen. He was a, caviar and...
Yeah, it was super easy.
Yeah,
never had a hard time.
Yeah, never had a hard day of life.
Thanks, man. So anyway, 146, what does that say?
$146.27.
Best $146.27 ever made, which I'm sure is something a lot of people will say about that. It really felt like, just a real significant moment to have someone write a check and with my name on it and sign it for something I had written. That I also think is the last money I made from that book, but that's okay. I was able to move to conventions, do other things with it. But it I don't know. It's very that's a question.
Or I was going to ask you, how did you become interested in luchadores?
It's funny. I have another old friend of mine. Let me be honest with you. My buddy Andy Deemer over there. Yeah, that's
Hi,
him. Great guy. He actually got me into luchadores. He has always liked them. And one time we were at a bar, and I was sort of pitching him this idea that sort of eventually became another image series of mine called 27, which we'll probably talk about in a minute.
Yep.
But at the time, that book was called Fun City, which is maybe even a better title. But it was very, very like complicated and elaborate, and it had like even just describing it to him took 45 minutes. And so he sat there patiently, drinking beers, we're in the bar, and at the end he's like, man, why don't you just do a book about a drunk luchador? That'd be fun. And so I did, and that was Strongman. I think he even has like a story concept co-created by credit in the book or something like that. So that is why, part of why I got interested in it, but then when I started like learning about what they were and what they meant, I just thought they were fascinating. They're like real life superheroes, they're insane. So I thought it was a very rich type of character to write about, especially one who's way past his prime. It just seemed compelling.
And it's a fun book. It's very Don Quixote in like the line between reality and fiction is blurred for the main character, and so it leads to like some fun sequences where you're like, wait, is he imagining this?
He's been hit in the head a lot.
It's cool.
So he's not really sure what's real and what's not around. It's fun.
So 27. So this was like in my mind. As an outsider, this was, Strongman was cool and all, and slave labor graphics, right on, but like, this to me, I was like, did you do a book for Image? Get out of what?
Yeah.
You did it!
I felt the same way. I remember coming home from, that book got picked up on the floor by Jim Valentino at C2E2 in probably 2010, something like that. And so, I remember coming home for that convention just feeling like I was, like, I had arrived. Image is a publisher of amazing, amazing comics. A lot of really spectacular people have gone through there. And to be part of that legacy was a big deal. So 27 was the next big project that I had out. It was about all those musicians who got of age 27. Jim Hendrix, Kurt Cobain, all those guys. And kind of put forth like a magical explanation, like a dark magic reason for that while that's happening. It's a fun book. But the nice thing about that, better than nice, like the amazing thing about that is that whereas Strongman, as you saw from that check, like it didn't get into too many people's hands, but it got into a couple of people's hands, and a couple of those people were people from the Bendis board that, as we mentioned at the beginning, your network doesn't have to be big for it to be effective, and so...
Especially in comics.
Yeah.
Throw a rock and you hit someone else that works in comics
and
you're at a convention. It's nice.
But Nick Spencer was the guy who... Oh, yeah, go ahead.
So it's kind of like stumbling into a situation that you just got into.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I stumbled into it. I worked really hard. Like, I flew out to a lot of conventions where I didn't have any hope of ever making any money back. I spent a lot of time online. I spent a lot of time, getting Strongman into people's hands. Like, I sort of stalked Tom Brevoort for a while and made sure that he had a copy of it. Like, just, there's a lot you can do. You just have to keep knocking on every door you can think of, and then eventually one of them opens. But in this case, Nick Spencer, who's another Marvel writer, had read Strongman, and we sort of were friends from the Bendis board, and so he put the 27 pitch directly into Valentino's hands on the floor at C2E2, and Jim was like, oh, I like this, and then that was it. But if I hadn't put all the work into making Strongman happen, that would never have happened with 27. So it is kind of, you sort of zigzag back and forth making opportunities, but it was cool.
Be really nice. Yeah. Never stop making shit. That's it.
Yeah, and be good. And be good.
Like, and be good. Be good at what you do, but even that is like, be consistent. You'll get better at what you're doing if you keep doing it. So just keep doing it and be nice throughout and make a bunch of friends.
Yeah.
How do you find that? How do you find that balance, Charles, between, you know, you want to keep working to get better, but at some point you have to show, like, when do you decide, okay, this is good enough to get it in front of some eyes?
Like I said, if you, I mean, I guess it's just a real self-test, right? So let's say you got a pitch in your hands, okay? And if I said, okay, show that to Tom Brewer right now, show that to Axel Rondo, show that to Dan Dio right now, would you be like, sweet, of course, I can't wait for them to see it, or would you be like, oh, you know? Like, that feeling, you're going to know that feeling instantly, and you're going to feel it, like, at a moment. And if you feel like that, and it's not just, like, nervousness, it's like, oh, shit, I only get one chance to make that first impression, and I don't know if it's this, then you know it's not ready.
Yes.
That's it, very simple.
And that's true. I self-published at least 3 books that I would never have felt comfortable bringing to an editor. It was just stuff that I was, like, happy to be publishing.
But that does not mean that it's not worth.
But it was worth doing them. Yeah,
absolutely. It's just like anything else. So you have to practice. You have to punch projects out. You have to get work done in order to get better at work. So, oh, go back one. That was cool.
Yeah. So that was early.
That was an early logo of 27. Yep. I was trying to figure out a way to make the logo sort of work as a reverse of each other. But anyway, I guess now I'm looking at Swamp Thing.
I don't know.
Just stop.
I don't know how to work it.
I know.
Sorry.
We all know.
Sorry.
So. As you,
hey, so, spoilers.
Swamp Thing.
Then you got a job at DC.
Yes, I did get a job at DC. That was...
hold on real quick. I wanted to ask, because I don't have a slide for this, but in between, so 27 happens,
yep.
And it was very exciting, and Charles, I was along for the ride at this point before, I was still reading everything, but I was lettering, so I
yeah.
lettered strong. Well, you lettered strong.
Terribly, yes,
horrible.
I did.
But if you buy it now, it's a ruler.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you can get it now, it's good. But then I lettered 27, I lettered some other, like, shorter things that he had done.
Yeah.
And then, so the process in between 27 and this
yeah.
was, like, 2 years, right? It was two
yeah.
or 3 years gap where, like, 27 was a thing now, and we got to do a second 27 mini-series.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was 2010, 2011 were the two 27 minis. And then I had another book called Strange Tractors that was put up by Archaea, which is now Boom, in between. But it took I had a completely dry year where nothing was coming out after the second volume of 27, which is really challenging because you see everybody else putting out projects, you really want to stay in the loop, you want to stay relevant, you want to have good new stuff, but you know, it's like what I was talking about before, the book's not ready. So, but eventually got Strange Tractors out, which is a book about New York City, and I don't think we have any stuff from it, but I have it at my table with people on it. And then at that point, 27 got a fair amount of attention, Strange Tractors got a fair amount of attention, and I've been doing like tons of shows, so my network had grown, and I had a lot of contacts, and I was at my table in San Diego, which is not actually how you say it, in San Diego, several years ago, and a guy named Jeff Boysen came up to my table, and he had tried 27 and really liked it. I showed him sort of an early kind of preview galley of Strange Tractors, and he checked that out, and he liked it, and he's like, you know, it would be cool if, you know, would you ever, how did he phrase it? He phrased it as very, he introduced himself as like a vice president of DC Comics, which was very cool, you know, when that happens. And he said, why aren't you doing anything for DC? And I'm like, you know, in my head I'm thinking, well, because you don't question
yourself
for DC. But of course,
I have. There's a million scripts
yes.
that no one cared about.
Exactly. But what I said was, you know, I would love to write something for DC. No one's asked me to, but I would be more than happy to if the opportunity arose. And he's like, all right, I'm going to put you in touch with the guy. And so that was July, and then nothing really happened until... following October, which was New York Comic Con, where I met Matt Eidelson, this Jeff Boysen guy, who's since become a very, very close friend. He now works over at Image Comics. He's a great guy, in part because he really kickstarted my career, but also because he's just a good dude. He introduced me to Matt Eidelson, who asked me to pitch on something, and he was very mysterious about it. He's like, I'll call you in a week or so, and I'll tell you what it is. So I'm thinking, what, you know, I'm racking my brain for this week to figure out what in the world this project was going to be that I didn't want before.
And then he calls me and he's like, okay, the book is Swamp Thing. And I freaked out for many reasons. One of the reasons is that Swamp Thing has been worked on by an absolute rogues gallery of some of the best writers of comics ever. Alan Moore, Len Wein,
Robert Kirkman. Nope, Brian K. Vaughan.
Brian K. Vaughan, Mark Miller, Grant Morrison, Joshua Dysart, Andy Diggle, and then the guy who was writing it at the time, Scott Snyder, who I'm sure many of you have heard as well, Batman writer. So I was going to be taking this book over from one of the most popular writers in the business after it had already been written by some of the most iconic writers in the business, period. And so I thought...
Robert Kirkman.
Yes, but not Robert Kirkman. So I thought... You know, I'm going to shoot for the fences, right? You know, it doesn't, I mean, I was very intimidated, I was terrified, but you don't say no to something like that. And I put a piece together, I worked really, really hard on it over the next week, handed it in, crossed my fingers, and then it all, you know, I got the job. But at that time, there was a lot of sort of flux in the DC Comics writers crew, and so I didn't know how long I'd actually be on it. And I assumed that it would be, there was a more than inconsequential chance that I might be off the book really, really quickly. So I decided that if I would only get to write one or two issues of Swamp Thing, of DC Comics at all, I would put Superman in them because I wanted to make sure that I'd get a chance to write Superman. And so the last page of my first Swamp Thing issue has Superman showing up, and he has one word. The line is Holland, because he's really mad at Alec Holland, and Alec Holland is Swamp Thing's human alter ego.
And as a testament to Charles, and then I'll take both questions, I think of, I don't know, countless number of things I've read. Most things, the first pitch that I read is very, very close to what it ends up being. So he has it's a very clear path from, at least from when I get it, mm-hmm. to when it ends up on the final page.
So you said, DC said you're going to do Swamp Thing,
mm-hmm.
and then in a week you gave them a pitch.
DC asked me if I would pitch on Swamp Thing, which is not the same thing as you're going to do Swamp Thing. But
oh,
so
okay.
So they said, you know, give us a pitch in a week.
So
yeah.
Did you start from zero, or did you have like ideas that you were like, does this work for Swamp Thing?
I had no idea. It would. No, I started from zero and being a big fan of Swamp Thing and having read the big runs. So I took my Swamp Thing amalgam in my head and then thought of what I thought was cool from those old runs, maybe what my new ideas could be, and then I synthesized them into a pitch that, as Sean mentioned, became pretty close to what I ended up doing. So,
yeah. How much did you know about what Scott Snyder had planned between when they asked you to pitch and what would be happening before your book came out?
Not much then. I mean, I had been reading his run. I think at that time it was up to maybe issue 12 or 13 or 14. So I knew what he was doing, but I didn't know him, I hadn't talked to him at all. And the first conversation, we've become super, super tight since then, but the first conversation I had with him was a phone call where I had this plot point that I wanted badly in my Swamp Thing run, and he didn't want it. Like he wanted because it would affect the ending of his run. And so our first conversation was like, and I was nobody, and he was, you know, way up there. And to his credit, he treated me like just like anybody else, and we had a conversation, like a thoughtful conversation about how it could work, and then it all worked really well. But I didn't know where he was going then, but I learned very quickly. Like, we had a bunch of conversations after that about it. So the handover was very gracious. I had a similar experience recently taking over Daredevil from Mark Waid, which was...
Oh, you jumped in.
All right. I guess we'll get there when
we had a Twitter question about Swamp Thing before we move on.
Okay.
We should. Whoever, some Twitter person, wanted to know what your thoughts on wrapping up this series, because that was also the first, and I've answered this question for you, but this was your first exiting out of the thing now.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
And then it was your first thing, and I can remember one of a handful of emails or calls that I've gotten over the years that was a panic, Charles, like, I sent you a thing, we need you to read it, and like, I don't know, I don't even know anymore. Daredevil was one of those things,
yeah.
The end of Swamp Thing was one of those things,
yeah.
And Star Wars stuff.
Yeah, the Lando, the first Lando issue. Yeah, all of the firsts of the Star Wars. Well, the first issues are crucial. You have to get it right. You have to get it right. And, you know, because if you don't, then you don't get to do more, and it really locks you into a tone and a feeling and all lots of other things. First issues are very challenging, but they're also really great because you get to make all those choices. And I feel like one of the things I'm pretty good at as far as a writing thing, not right now, my words are no good, but is single issues. I'm good at single issue stories. I'm good at doing a 20-page story, and so I tend to think of single issues, and if you look at a lot of my first issues in my runs, they feel like that. They have a beginning. You can read it almost as one story, but yet you're intrigued and want to go further. I don't like to leave people, leave them hanging in a good way, sort of, but, yeah.
So, and then wrapping up Swamp Thing?
Sure.
What was that like?
It was challenging. I think I had maybe the second longest run on that book after Alan Moore. So I did this big, huge epic story, had a million plot threads to pull home, and I was nervous about it because I was putting the character to bed for a little while. He's back, for sure. So it was nerve-wracking. Luckily they gave me this expanded issue to really be able to tell everything. I tend to build myself too much story for the finales that I get. I think this one worked really, really well. You can see that's not just one thing, that's like Swamp Thing, that's like a thousand Swamp Things. That's Jesus Saez, who was unbelievably good.
I like the dinosaur.
Yeah, the dinosaur Swamp Thing. Because there's been Swamp Things all throughout recorded history, so there's been Swamp Things of all eras, and, you know, anyway.
And also...
No, Popcorn Thing was in it.
Did.
Yeah,
Popcorn Thing. That was the one thing. It had a much larger role. Popcorn Thing was... came out of a movie theater out of a kernel of popcorn that Swamp Thing had willed himself into, and then he popped himself into a Swamp Thing, but made of popcorn. It was my favorite thing.
You know,
and
it's possible people might not know
what
Swamp Thing's powers. So Swamp Thing can occupy and emerge from any plant, anywhere. And so, but because he looks like a horrible monster thing, he lives in the swamp. That's why it's called Swamp Thing. And so he gets very bored in the swamp, and he's kind of mad. He used to be a dude who could do cool dude things, and now he can't. So he decides to get him to go to the movies. And the way he goes to the movies is by pouring himself up out of one of those kernels of popcorn on the floor of the movie theater into a tiny little popcorn thing who's about this tall. And he's like, he was really cute. And he's hiding in the aisle, and he's watching the movie.
And he runs around in the theater.
Well, hold on. And then an old lady across the aisle, looks and is like, ah. So Swamp Popcorn Thing runs up the aisle, shedding little bits and pieces of popcorn and corn husks and things like that as it goes. And it's a great, it's fun, it's a great scene, and it really illustrates, I think, his, you know, where his head is or was at. But I put that in my first issue initially. And the problem was that everybody who read it, I think including you, really liked it. But it was like a three-page scene that didn't feel at all like the rest of the tone.
Yep.
And so the rest of my Swamp Thing run, which was long, was trying to figure out a way to fit that scene in somewhere.
Every issue you would send it, like, did you figure it out? And he's like, no, man, it doesn't work. There's like dead people dying, and
it was very grim, very
monsters,
grim.
And I'm like, yeah, there's this little popcorn guy.
But Popcorn Thing did make it into the second annual, when he is, the way that I did it was he has his friend, Capucine, who's a French assassin woman, who's lived 1,000 years. Swamp Thing is a very cool book. You get to do all kinds of weird stuff. So she is dying. So it's very dark again. She's been poisoned. She's dying. And to cheer her up and to make her sort of distract her, he tells her the story of Popcorn Thing. And so it did make it in finally.
Nice.
But anyway.
So Swamp Thing moved. Oh, sorry. You had a. He had one first, and then we got to go back.
If you were still with DC, what character would you like to have written besides Swamp Thing?
This sounds weird, but I think I could do something cool with Owlerman. You know, he's a JSA character who I always just thought was neat. I think I could do something. I think I've got some cool like villain stories. I bet I could do a really good Lex Luthor story, like a bigger Lex Luthor story. It'd be fun to have a crack at Batman. You know, of course, I never really had a big Batman run or something like that. I like Wonder Woman. I do more Wonder Woman.
Very cool.
I like a lot of these books. We'll see.
Cool.
Could you talk a bit about the process of going from that original pitch being accepted to developing this whole long arc that you did, and
sure.
How that came about?
I had a pitch that talked about the pitching is sort of an arc. You want to give the editors a sense that you know what you're doing, that you understand the character, and a lot of that is feel stuff.
you know, it's going to feel like this with a touch of this. And if you refer to a previous writer's runs, that makes you look like you know what the hell you're doing. You've done your homework. I tend to give them a feel of what the book will read like. You know, so it's going to be like this. I really like this element. I like the idea. I remember saying very specifically that one of the things I really like about Swamp Thing is that he could grow up out of any plant on the planet, so he could have adventures anywhere. So I wanted to have a book that was very global in scope. And so he goes to China, he goes to Scotland,
opens in the Middle East.
Yeah, it's all over the place. And the world has many interesting environments, not all of which are, good for plants. And so it just needs to put in a lot of space. So I talked about that, and then you have to say, okay, that's a very broad, like a 10,000 foot top level thing that needs to turn into issues and arcs and things like that. So from there, I thought I needed to figure out a plan for how I would approach that. And so what I ended up doing with Swamp Thing was I talked, and I do this in stuff that's going to be longer. Like there's one of these for Daredevil too that I haven't really talked about. But I tend to have a big theme in mind so that I kind of have a roadmap to it. And the theme for Swamp Thing was about the meta theme was about me as a writer dealing with the incredible legacy of Swamp Thing writers that were sort of breathing down my neck. And so the first big arc, if you look at the stories in it, a lot of it is looking backward and talking about, what kind of Swamp Thing is Swamp Thing going to be when there's been all these other amazing Swamp Things in the past? How is Alec Holland going to be this time, right? So you get it. And then the second arc is all talking about he's established, he's got his place, but is he actually going to be any good at it? Is he going to actually do something that matters? Is he going to leave a legacy that's important as a Swamp Thing or as a Swamp Thing writer? And then the third arc, the finale, was talking about in what state am I going to leave this character when I'm done? You know, what is the world of Swamp Thing going to look like when I'm finished with it? And so that third arc is all about him dealing with the emergence of a new kingdom in the, the machines basically come to life and start.
And I don't remember attacking plants in the final version, but Alan Moore was in your, Alan Moore Swamp Thing was in
No,
your,
he's the, he is, he's in, yeah, Alan Moore, yeah, so
it's, I mean, it got very, well, and Snyder, but that never made it.
Yeah, right? There was a scene that Scott Snyder originally showed up in the last issue of Swamp Thing. As himself.
It got very, like,
he was wearing a Batman shirt, he was being very chatty, it was fun, but, I ended up cutting it. But at some point I'll probably release those script pages because they're
going to push us.
Yeah.
We should move on Swamp.
Yeah.
Can we get a Funko Pop? Can we get a Funko Popcorn thing?
I mean, yes.
Yes, we can.
Right in campaign.
Yes.
Dear Funko, Popcorn thing. Love everyone.
Yeah.
So
Red Lanterns.
Red Lanterns also happened.
Yes.
At DC.
It was my second series.
And then this was
Superman Wonder Woman.
This
yeah.
was another one that that I got a very scared email call situation. Like,
yeah.
So they wanted to make Superman Wonder Woman a couple. Should they do this? And I was like, yeah, do it. What do you mean? He's like, yeah, but it seems really hard. And then the more we talked about it, the harder it did seem to really make work and do any kind of justice to. And I know that one of your goals going in was that you wanted it to be a relation. Like, if Charles had been able to do anything he wanted, it would have been a 15-issue book of, like, them going on dates.
Yeah,
like,
my original book was a lot of dates.
Yeah, like, a lot of dates. They went to clubs. They were people, like, doing people stuff, you know? Like, waking up in the morning and, like, rolling over and she's got morning breath. And, like, he made them and he wanted to really get as much of that in. And I think...
Yeah, it was a...
You should talk a little about the...
Sure, I mean, it's push and pull, right? These are iconic characters for DC so they... But it's not a bad thing, you know. Your editors are there to help you get to a place where you can do great work within whatever framework they're looking for too. I mean, DC owns these characters, and it's a privilege to work on them. So I did get a bunch of that stuff in over time. It just wasn't quite as it's huge superhero epic action, which is great, and it's one of the biggest superhero books I've done, and I'm really proud of it from that perspective. But I also feel like within that, I wrote them like people in a relationship, even though they're fighting gods and monsters. And so it was neat to challenge myself to get what I wanted out of it while also keeping it big and true to the tone that DC was looking for. So, that's just writing, man. That's the gig.
Yeah, I wanted to ask, what was your favorite issue in the whole Superman Wonder Woman?
That one is actually pretty fun. It's a one shot. I believe that's the last issue, right?
I think so. Yeah.
It's one where they basically get. So in one of the early issues, Superman gives Wonder Woman a Kryptonian plant as a gift, and Wonder Woman like goes on adventures and forgets to water it, and so it turns into a
monster.
Yeah, it turns into a monster. She's supposed to water with cooking oil because it's from Krypton, and so it like doesn't take water, and so she forgets. And so it turns into a monster that runs off and starts drinking up all the oil in the world. So they have to stop it before it drinks all the oil in the world. And so that's kind of the big, you know, the monster plot. But the story that's actually happening is that they're having a huge gigantic argument about the fact that Wonder Woman forgot to water this damn plant and what that means and all that.
I bought you this gift, don't you care?
Yeah, you know, just like, you know, stuff. We had those conversations. And so it was really fun to write it. Again, it's one of those one shots. I really do like one issue stories when I can do them. That is only about, you know, it's about that. It's about all these different things, all these different layers, and it puts I thought it put a really nice pin in there.
That's another series that if you can release a script book to release the original, like, concepts for a lot, because a lot of those scripts had way more relationship stuff than the final version ended up having, because you had to make room and something.
Yeah.
You know.
But it was a big book. That was probably my biggest, like, big book.
Well, then that got you to...
Actually, what got me to Thunderbolts was that book, I took over Thunderbolts from Daniel Way with issue 13.
And that was your first Marvel.
That was my first Marvel, issue 12. The book that got me there was Red Lantern. I was doing Swamp Thing, Red Lanterns. I don't think I started on Superman 1, but there's an editor there named Jordan White who hired me to work on that, who has since hired me to work on lots of books, including the Star Wars stuff. So it's been, that was a huge thing to have a foot in both worlds.
Before I get to your question, I have a question if you briefly want to touch on the differences between pitching to Marvel and DC. And specifically to you, though, the DC pitch was like your first big two pitch,
mm-hmm.
So there were nerves to go along with that. Was it the same feeling when you got to pitch to Marvel and step up to that plate, or was it a little easier at that point because you're like, well, I wrote...
Well, this was... Originally, they hired me for two issues because they assumed that what was going to happen was I would... It was... They were filling issues. Like, sometimes, for whatever reason, somebody gets sick, somebody gets behind, they need someone to write a script very quickly to get drawn to make sure that the trains keep running on time. So the first two issues of Thunderbolts were fill-ins. And the expectation, Jordan was very clear about it up front, and it wasn't like I was being treated poorly, it was still an amazing opportunity, was that I would write these two and then I would be done, and maybe there'd be something else down the road. But the two issues I turned in, they really liked the script, and they're like, you know, maybe we don't need to look for somebody else to keep writing the series, maybe you could do it, what would you do? And so then I had to, again, very, very quickly, like, the thing that characterizes a lot of the... Where are you going back? characterized a lot of the Marvel stuff that I did early on is that I had to pitch really, really fast. I had to come up with ideas super quickly. But it worked out. Thunderbolts was a blast. My run on it lasted till about issue 28, during which I also worked on, I don't know if you have...
I do, hold on.
Yeah, okay. There we go, She-Hulk. Which is a book that I loved, and thank you for liking it too. And it was very special. That I think is the book that really moved me into a kind of another level of people thinking what I was capable of. Yeah.
So the reason why we came, my boyfriend is like really, really, really into comics. I'm still new to the comic world.
Okay.
I'm super impressed as a professional, I'm a software developer.
Uh-huh.
When I try to do creative stuff, I get home and I'm just exhausted.
Mm.
How do you have the time to do all three of these hobbies and like in a profession that are all very time-consuming?
You mean lawyering and writing and
like
music
sleep.
And everything? I love all
cocaine,
which is
duh.
Which is a big part. Cocaine, okay, no, always.
I can only assume you sleep like 2 hours a night, maybe.
I try to sleep as much as I can. But I also, I mean, this is work that I love doing. I get a rush out of it. It's like, you know, it's like a runner's high. You know, I feel very like, yeah. And also the law practice, it's my practice. So it's my own like little firm, or however you want to think about it. So I'm able to manage my time that way. So I don't have to spend 10 hours a day on law, like at an office with bosses. So that helps a lot. I think I'm wired to be able to do it. I don't have a great answer other than I just sit down and do it.
There is an adrenaline. I mean, because I I work and then go and write and put out books, and it's there's definitely like a butterfly to it, for sure.
There's an endorphin that kicks in, and you're like, now I get to do my own thing. You know, and then you get into a thing, and then you're excited, and you don't want to stop because like it's coming out. I mean, it's very easy when it's not coming out to be like, I worked all day, Netflix, but when you're in it, I think you're in it, and if it's driving you to do something that you want to do, then you just do it. You have to.
Yeah. There's no. This sounds kind of glib, but I just decided. I just made a decision, and anybody's capable of making that decision. Just have to decide.
Yeah.
You know. Now I'm getting through all these books, man. There's a lot. Like what happened was, so I was working at Marvel and DC at the same time on a huge stack of books. Like I think it would have been November of 2013, something like that. I had like 11 different titles out that month. It was brutal. And so it kind of became clear to me that I was going to have to settle down.
Charles also stays pretty ahead though. Like even in that time, you tend to get stuff to me
six to eight months
before it will, you know, be a real thing.
Yeah.
What does your kid think about all the issues you have done? Or?
She hasn't read a lot of movies, so not.
If he ever got to see her, then
I know the answer to that question. I'll ask her someday. But no, she thinks it's cool. She comes to get nice with me sometimes and sits at the table, which is fun getting at her, you know, and she thinks I'm like real famous, which is very sort of horrible. But anyway, cool. So anyway, so what kind of what happened? I don't know if you had a Death Wolverine slide in there anyway, but
oh man, I don't. I forgot.
So that existed.
Sorry, Death Wolverine was cool.
Yeah, the big project that kind of made me go on a Marvel path was Death Wolverine. They asked me to do that book, and all I had done for them at that point was Thunderbolts and She-Hulk. So I just started doing him. So basically, it was very like, I almost couldn't believe it. Like, Death of Wolverine is a huge book, and I was working with Steve McDiven, who's one of my favorite people and artists to this very day. And that leveled me up significantly to the point where, I signed an exclusive contract with Marvel. I've been working with Marvel exclusively now for a year and change. We'll be there for the time being. And they're giving me some amazing books to work on.
One here and then one there.
Mm-hmm.
So you went from Swamp Thing, which is a singular character out there.
Mm-hmm.
You had a lot, kind of an ensemble cast. You went from that to Red Lanterns. Was that kind of a challenge being early on that you were worried about? Like,
I remember being on a panel and asking Jonathan Hickman and Nick Spencer, because they both done a bunch of team book stuff, how do you approach a team book? And then they said, well, basically you split them up a lot. So you find reason for the team to go in different places, so that you're essentially writing single character books. But that's an issue to issue solution. But really, what you have to do is you have to be aware of the arcs of everybody, right? So pushing everybody forward, giving everybody a little beat every issue. Sometimes you push somebody to prominence. You give feature issues, like in Humans book that I'm doing now, in Canon Humans, the cast of characters, like there's like 20 main characters, maybe more. So it's like this uber team, and what I'm doing is
there you go.
There you go. I mean, there's like that's the cast, and so I have to try and give all those people meaningful beats. And so what
and
I people and oh, and a giant dog thing.
Thank you.
Meaningful beats. And so I think of it like a rotating wheel, right? There are people that are in the center who are the leads of the book. You've got Medusa, Black Bolt, people like that. But then around it are all these spokes on that wheel. And as the wheel rotates, every once in a while one of them is coming up to the top, and they get their moment to shine, right? So everybody comes around, and while the leads are in the center of this.
Do you prefer one over the other?
They flex different muscles. A really great team can be a blast to write. If everybody's gelling, you can make it all work. Red Lanterns was nice because I kind of got to, well, actually, in Human's a better example. In Human, I've been able to kind of design the team as I wanted, and then a ton of my own characters, and so I've been able to kind of plug people into the various spots I wanted, so it's been really fun. But Daredevil is like a dream book because it's a great single character book, and I can do this incredibly layered, dense psychological thing for him that would be much harder to do if he was part of a 10-person
team. I'm going to throw this guy real quick because he has an ass one, and then we'll...
I'm just curious with like the Inhumans and the upcoming film of it.
Sure.
Is there coordination between like the cinematic universe and you? Like, we want this character, we want everyone to know this, or like start setting this up so people...
I wouldn't say so much... That I don't. That doesn't happen.
It's because no one's as far as I know, no one's asked you to set something up.
No, but what I mean, the movie's not out until 2019, which is sooner than it was a year ago, obviously. But it's wait, explain that. Yeah. but it's a little ways out. And so I know that they're reading them. For example, I mean, one of my characters, a huge thrill is that a guy named up in Lash in the very first issue of my Inhuman series was on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., who was one of the big bad guys of the season. So it's yeah, that's a good picture. So it was very that was like a huge thrill, you know, just to see that happen. So it's so far, stuff tends to go that way as opposed to coming back the other direction. But on the other hand, you know, I'm sure that the way everybody looks in Captain America Civil War is going to be the way they start to look in comics, just because there's this, like, it's not intentional, just artists just do what they do. And Daredevil is sort of an exception to that, because we're specifically not drawing him in the TV show's costume, because Ron Garney came up with this amazing sort of boxing-inspired look for him that I think is super rad. And yeah, there you go. He just looks fantastic with his new apprentice Blindspot there.
What was Blindspot's original name?
Brother Ghost. I had a lot of
yeah,
ton
there was
of
a
ton
lot of
ideas for him.
Yeah, good. Blindspot went through a lot of names and
yeah.
Something good and something.
Yeah. I wanted something that felt inspired by Chinese mythology, sort of. And you know, I lived in Asia for a while growing up, and I speak Chinese to a greater or lesser
do some now.
Degree of fluency. We also saw the title of
what?
Shinzai.
That's nuts.
So, what? Andy Weaver also speaks Chinese better than I do.
Andy Weaver speaks some Chinese!
Alright.
Go
so,
ahead.
Anyway.
In the back.
I have Death of Wolverine is something that Marvel brought to you. How much of it was something that they said, this is what you're doing?
None
doing
of it, other than here's the title.
Okay.
And Stephen was drawing it. So,
none of it, because that was my first question when I got the call, and I was like, well, what did they want you to do? He's like, I don't know, dude.
that was another scary one, because you got to distill 4 years of character into one huge book, or one big moment, really. It's really those last three pages that have to sell the whole damn thing. So that was a hard one, but all right.
Then the woman in the back.
You talked a little earlier about the handover of Daredevil.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little more about that?
Sure. So there was a big event at Marvel this past summer called Secret Wars, and during that event, none of the regular books were being titled or published. So everything kind of paused. There was a 3-month pause button. That was it. And Mark had been writing the book for, I think, 5 years at that point. So he was ready to step off. And it was the spring of last year that he told Marvel that. And so I was very lucky that I was on a short list of people to be approached to take it over from him. So Mark is one of the best guys in comics, for sure, both talent-wise and good guy-wise. So he was immediately super excited for me and super gracious about telling me what he had planned, adjusting some of his beats, unlike that Scott's not a guy, to make sure that where I wanted to start would work. And it was very interesting. We have these Marvel Writers Summits 2 times a year, sometimes 3, where we all get together in a huge conference room in New York City and we hash out the big event that's coming for the next year. And Mark Waid was, we had one last fall, and Mark was there, and he had just read the first issue of Daredevil. And I was terrified, because Mark is one of my writing heroes, and he's been a writing hero for a long time, and I know I might consider him a friend. And I was very nervous about it, because my book does not take any of his book, really. It doesn't take the characters, except for the most basic parts of it. Foggy Nelson is in it, but otherwise you don't see any of the characters from his run. The tone, it looks completely different.
It switches cities.
It feels completely different. It breaks up the relationship that he spent like 3 years building, all of this stuff. And I was terrified, because if he's like, you son of a bitch, then that would have been a bad moment. And what he said was, you know, Charles, it was really good. I'm like, oh, thanks, Mark, thank God. He's like, and then he goes, you really changed a lot of stuff. And I said, I know, and sort of we went through it. And I just felt that for me, when you have a signature, like a really signature run like that run was, it was one of the best I've ever, and I read them all, and that run was one of the best that has ever been done on my character, for sure. I felt that I needed to, for better or for worse, you know, I mean, mine could be terrible, but I needed to do something that was my own. So, like, I didn't watch the TV show until I had my take. I'd written, like, 4 scripts before I even looked at the TV show. I just really wanted to do something that felt like this is Charles Soule and Ron Garney's version of Daredevil. So, you know, that's why that happened that way. He was awesome about it, continues to be awesome about it, at least to me. Maybe he hates me privately. anyway, so I hope that answers your question.
This gentleman and then that gentleman. Yes.
With She-Hulk and Daredevil, is there a balance you have to find between getting the legal stuff right, so it satisfies you as someone who has obviously probably gotten angry at some of the way
yeah.
legal issues are portrayed
sure.
media and making it entertaining.
Yeah, that's there's a push and pull with that for sure. Like there's dramatized legal stuff, and then there's real legal stuff. But I think fortunately, because I am in the profession and I've been in the profession for a while, I'm able to see my way through to making it feel more realistic than it otherwise might. Daredevil is now a prosecutor, so he's moved into the DA's office, which every other iteration of Daredevil, as far as I know, he's been a defense attorney. So he's gone, he's turned evil almost, he's turned the other side. Which I always thought, to me it seemed like a...
Lawyer speak, he's evil now.
Yeah. To me it seemed like an obvious choice for a vigilante to be going and actually putting the guys in jail after he punches them on rooftops. Yes, that sounds kind of weird when I say it, but that was the thinking.
Sounds like he's being a real jerk about it, actually.
So the problem, or the issue, the complication was that I've never been a prosecutor, I've never really done much litigation. So I met with a bunch of DA people, ADAs, and talked to them and ex-ADAs and asked them what it was like and sort of what would it be like if this sort of rich, famous lawyer dude came into your office, would he be treated nicely or not? And they're like, nah, man, they would. Like tease him, and it would be kind of rough for him, and all this stuff. So, I feel like if you look at the way I'm writing Daredevil, like it's and She-Hulk too. Like I got into legal stuff, but I didn't often get really, really deep into it because that's boring, you know. So you kind of skate over it, and when you need to go deep, you go deep. But otherwise, you kind of give it a sheen of reality, and then people think you know you're good.
With Death of Wolverine, was it known that Laura was going to take over as Wolverine, and how do you feel about that?
I think it's great. I think that she's an awesome character. I wrote her a lot in, this is X-23, Laura Kinney. I think that
Lady Ween.
She's Wolverine. So I think she's cool. I think it was...
Wolverine?
No. I thought that she deserved her chance to spotlight, and I think that having Old Man Logan as a prominent part of the Marvel Universe is great too. So I Logan was everywhere.
Girlgan?
And he still pops up in a lot of books today as like a sort of ghost and things like that. So I did want Logan to come back quickly because I think that would sort of decrease the sort of the big punctuation mark that I put in the end of my story. So as far as I'm concerned, Logan doesn't even come back for like a decade. But I think the Marvel Universe to stay cool and relevant, that churn is really important. So new characters coming to the fore, new stories being told with new people is great. So yeah, well, we're really moving through time.
Yeah. Alright, well so
all right, let's keep doing the
We got 5 minutes.
Is there anything? Alright, so we'll
and
have
to know and some Star Wars.
Yeah, doing Star Wars books.
Okay,
all right.
So
that's the thing.
Star Wars,
Spider-Man.
Yeah,
Poe Dameron, Letter 44, big creator book. I got some more stuff coming out in the future.
Yeah,
that's gonna be cool.
Blah, blah, blah. Star Wars is really tough to write.
Yeah, it was really good.
How did that sneak in there? Right. What?
Okay, so I can maybe squeeze in one or two quick questions. Who's
yeah.
that? All right, that fellow in the back there.
Wait, speak up.
Yeah, Elektra's showing up in issue 6, and then I've got a Bullseye story I'm going to tell. There's a character who's been gone for a long time who's going to pop up. As you've heard from this panel, I'm a big planner, and so I've got a big, like, 3-year plan for Daredevil that has a lot of cool stuff in it. So, all right.
So, spoiler free, what is your, like, meta story that you were putting into Daredevil? So, this is what we're going to put one thing.
Oh, I'm not going to tell you yet. Sorry. It's only 4 issues, and I don't want to, like, spoil it. But.
There's really great Daredevil stuff. I'm a huge Daredevil. This was one of the books that was like, you're doing it? Yeah! Now I get to know what happens before it happens. And Daredevil's really, it's holding up to my expectations, which were very high for Daredevil. So there's a lot of cool stuff coming.
I'll tell you one thing that's cool. So Ten Fingers is the new villain for the first arc. He's got 10 fingers on each hand, which looks super weird. He's creepy.
It's gross.
I want to introduce another big new villain for the second big arc, which will start in issue 9 or 10, who is a serial killer who is motivated by creativity. And he is really neat, and he's a strange, weird, cool new foe for Daredevil, and I think he will him, maybe?
Yeah.
I guess we'll see.
He'll
be creeped out by him, but you know.
Yeah.
Any other questions? We probably, yeah.
Just to jump off his question was, how do you feel about the way the Netflix Daredevil show, if you've watched it, how it plays with the whole law? How do they, how their approach to
I thought it was pretty good, actually. You know, I think that they're portraying them as a scrappy young upstart, you know, a couple of smart Columbia lawyers, which is a great story arc to work with. You know, like they seem a little like super expert-y and like real lawyers don't know everything about everything. I mean, I do, but most lawyers don't. And so it's you know, there's that's one of those TV tropes you see all the time. It just doesn't happen a lot. So,
anyone else?
How much did you being a lawyer influence them giving you She-Hulk or asking you to write She-Hulk?
It certainly did. There's no doubt about it. That was part of the initial conversation on She-Hulk, and part of my initial pitch for that too, for sure. And then when I did that book the way I did it, immediately, like, Axel Alonso, like, for like a year or so, was like, well, no, maybe someday I'll get to do Daredevil. I'm like, all right, maybe I will. That'd be cool. So, yes, it was a big part of it. So, all right, that is the last question. Yes.
All right, books like Swamp Thing and Daredevil, you came onto properties that you were already a fan of and knew about. Were there any books that you were brought onto of characters that you didn't know about and you had to, like, research?
Red Lantern was like that. I didn't really know about that at all.
Didn't die. I was getting those scripts going, wait, who are these characters?
Yeah. So that was it. That's part of the job. You know, it's fun to read. I like that. Just read comics for a little bit. So, all right, so thank you. This is a nice little thing. Thank you very much for coming.